Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's time to sit down, put things away, listen, and think. In our soundbite society, vapor-paced lives, you may find true comfort in taking the time to pay attention to someone who has done a lot of thinking while we haven't had time. For the next half hour, you will get a mainline transfusion of important ideas. Ideas that will stand as sentinels to survival. When I return, Dr. Paul Ehrlich on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I am honored to bring to my audience of sensitive, caring, intelligent friends, a sensitive, caring, and intelligent man, Dr. Paul Ehrlich. Scholar, author, and peaceful warrior for humanity, nature, and our future, I welcome you, Dr. Ehrlich, to the Wildside News. Hello. I'm sorry, we're having a difficulty here. I don't understand why. Dr. Ehrlich?
I hear you.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. There was some sort of mix-up on the phone line here. I apologize.
Doesn't matter.
Did you hear my little introduction then?
Yeah. I can't recognize myself, but I heard it.
Well, you know, to each his own, okay? Well, listen, you have written a new book following on, of course, the population bomb, which is called One with Nineveh. And let's start out and just give our listeners some ideas on why you came up with that title at this time.
Well, Nineveh was the capital of the first great empire in the world. It was a very rich empire, built huge castles, lots of art, marched all over the place and stole other people's stuff and sent it back, occupied territories and sent the good stuff back to Nineveh. When Austin Henry Layard, a British archaeologist, got to the site of Nineveh in about 1848, it was a pile of rocks, sort of a pile of dirt and rocks in the desert. And what had happened is that this fantastic empire, besides being involved in a lot of battles and so on, was slowly destroying its environment. It had an irrigation system where their fields salted up, and it was located at the northeast corner of the Fertile Crescent, and it deforested the mountains, ruining their water supply. It had to deforest the mountains because it had to burn a lot of wood to heat its palaces. All of this happened about 2,600 years ago. The interesting thing is that there's another empire that now is occupying Nineveh. Nineveh is in the outskirts of Mosul. Our tanks are over there. Our troops are over there, unfortunately getting killed. And they're over there doing something, again, which is part of the ecological ruination of the empire. That is, we're trying to get more oil when we should be stopping burning fossil fuels as rapidly as possible. And if you think we're in Iraq for any other reason besides oil, then I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I would love to sell you.
I want to encourage you to address this audience openly and passionately, because we're actually talking about our future on this planet, so the forum is open. One with Nineveh, subtitled Politics, Consumption, and the Human Future, it's a book about all of us that defines an urgency about our future and suggests that we are, to a large extent, caught in a hurricane of change powered by an ever-centralizing vortex of money, power, media, religion, and might. And you surmise that unless somehow we alter this storm of change, many humans on this planet are heading for a disastrous struggle with the nature that supports us.
Yep, that's exactly right. And actually, we're in the process of trying to do that at this very moment, because one of the problems we have increasingly in the world and in the United States is centralization of the main media. I don't know if you've seen Out Fox, the little documentary done on Fox News, but we have one of our major news channels is just a 24-hour propaganda machine that doesn't give news at all, and yet many people think it's news. So one of the great hopes, of course, is things like Wildside Radio.
Thank you very much.
But so people don't know what's going on in the world. They've been sold. I mean, I think most people now understand it wasn't weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It obviously wasn't just getting rid of Saddam Hussein, since there are many other nasty dictators around the world. As one of my colleagues said, you really think we'd be invading Iraq if its main export were broccoli? It's sitting on the second largest known supply of oil in the world. Oil is getting to be shorter and shorter. The Chinese want oil. They're beginning to look towards the Caspian Basin. The Afghanistan, of course, is a central place for gas supplies. We are trying to maintain the basis of our current lifestyle, particularly the driving of large SUVs and Hummers. When you see somebody driving around in a Hummer with an American flag on it, always remember that there are American kids dying in Iraq in order to keep that Hummer in an oversupply of gasoline.
Your book is an extraordinary investigation and interpretation based on years of research, and I must say there must be about 40 or 50 pages of very detailed notes and at the end of the book. And by the way, the book is published by Island Press, who are doing some wonderful publications these days. I encourage people to check that out. You certainly, I think, give a perspective on the fact that this consumer-driven, centralizing force is what is driving this. And, of course, as you talk about what's happening in Iraq right now, that is part of that process. Just how difficult is this becoming for us?
Well, it's becoming extremely difficult. And, of course, finally, I just saw the news today that the U.S. Congress has recognized the fact that the climate is changing rather dramatically due to our activities. We are, and of course, there's no small connection to our terrorism fears and so on and so forth. We are, the problems are basically that there are too many people in the world, that the rich people in the world consume much more than their share by any standards of the world's goods, and in the process cause huge amounts of environmental damage, and that, as indicated by the use of Hummers instead of bicycles, we are using, in many cases, the wrong technologies to accomplish what we want to accomplish. I should say, by the way, that, yeah, all of this stuff may sound far out to some of your readers, but if they take a look at the book and look at the list of acknowledgments, they'll see that a huge number of scientists have reviewed the book very carefully, and including economists, by the way, because we work very closely with economists who are concerned about these problems, and I mean like Nobel laureate economists, and that the scientific community has been saying this sort of thing for a long time. And one of the big issues is how power is distributed in our society that keeps the vast majority of people totally unaware of what's actually going on in the world.
Well, that is part of the massive problem. That's the fact that I really think we have answers all over the place. I believe there's thousands, perhaps even millions of people who get it in the United States alone. It's just that how in the world do we organize this information and then have that somehow influence our policies? And so much of that has to do with the media and, again, this process of globalization. Let's talk about that and globalization, because we hear a lot about that, and it means many different things to different people. But from your perspective, tell us about globalization.
Well, what globalization basically is a breaking down of national boundaries and creating a single global economy. And unfortunately, it's based on a very weak understanding on the part of people at organizations like the World Trade Organization, the U.S. government, and so on how economics actually works and what good ideas and bad ideas are. In other words, when you hear all of this stuff about free trade, it sounds wonderful. If you go back, if you read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and other works of that time, the idea of free trade was that everybody would be better off if there were free trade. The trouble is that in Adam Smith's day, it was assumed there were going to be nations, national economies, and that neither people nor capital would move around a lot. And under those circumstances, indeed, free trade was a pretty good idea. Now it's a very complex idea. Suddenly, capital can move around the world in nanoseconds, and people are moving around. idea that it's a wonderful thing to break down all national boundaries and suddenly have a total global economy run by a few big corporations is a very complicated idea that's got a lot of downsides, and we talk about this a lot in the book. But basically, it ends up with poor people getting screwed. Poor farmers, for example, who make less than $2 a day, and that's 3 billion people in the world make less than $2 a day, they're beginning to realize that European cows are subsidized to the tune of $2.50 a day, that in fact the free trade system and the non-tariff barriers and so on works entirely to the benefit of the rich, and it screws over the poor. And unfortunately, from the point of view of the rich, the poor are getting themselves nuclear weapons.
Well, you know, part of the globalization process certainly has China involved in this, and China is an enormous new player in the planet. And certainly your book deals with the concept that people in China actually are being turned into consumers as part of the globalization process by corporations around the world, and it raises the question of whether or not they're going to have the right to have all the same stuff that we do. As in terms of where corporations are kind of moving, it feels as if they really believe it's possible.
They don't understand what limits there are, that's a really difficult problem. And by the way, in China, which used to have one of the more equitable societies on the planet, the inequity is beginning to really become serious. Actually the theologian named John Cobb wrote a very interesting thing about the point you just made. He said he was looking at the possible events as the people who run the earth slowly discover that there are biophysical limits to growth, that there that we can't just keep expanding our activities forever. And what that means in terms of the need for labor, what he wrote was, once the ruling class realizes that the amount of economic activity that the planet can sustain will never have the need of the labor of billions of Earth's present inhabitants, interest in their survival will diminish. The world decision makers will find that a greatly reduced population would be preferable. The underclass will appear not only as superfluous, but also as an impediment to the well-being of those people who are productive. If, in desperation, the underclass turns to violence, then the powers that be will have the excuse they need to eliminate many of its members. That's John Cobb, a very well-known theologian, talking about exactly what's happening today. That the underclass is turning to violence, and the powers that be, God knows what they're going to do.
Well, this is unfortunately the scenario that seems to be developing every day. And I know that from my perspective, and probably most of the listeners, and most people I actually know, there's a sense that somehow there's a train wreck that we're headed for, but we seem not to have any capacity to influence that future. I mean, the people do have answers. There's many people like yourself who have laid these warnings out. I try to give the warnings without scaring people a lot, but just say, hey, something really truly is going wrong here, but how? Now, you also, in your book, by the way, is tremendously well documented about where we are, and you talk about the human predicament, which I encourage people to really take a look at and define and understand, but you also talk about where and how possibly we may be able to have a better future. Let's talk about that. We've got about 3 minutes in this segment left.
There's lots of things that we could do, as you indicate, and unfortunately we have moronic leadership, and it doesn't seem likely we're going to change it, but for example, our Congress isn't working the way that the Founding Fathers wanted, for a lot of reasons we could discuss, but there are ways of changing that, and for example, getting the Congress more able to focus on some of the long-term problems instead of the ones that can only be solved in 2 or 6 years. We should be examining much more closely the way we treat corporations and what rights we give to corporations. The idea that a corporation is a fictitious individual that should have the right to free speech is nonsensical. It wasn't handed down by God in tablets carved on a mountain somewhere. It was developed by clever railway lawyers in about 1875. We should be looking, and many people have written on this, what should be done to make corporations more responsible. We need to look at international governance much more closely. The thing that I and my colleagues are pushing very hard now is to have what we call a millennium assessment of human behavior. That is to start a worldwide discussion, much like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does on our climate change problems, to look at how we treat each other and our environment and to suggest ethical ways of changing things, and particularly looking at the ethics of what we leave to our children and grandchildren, because the big issue, or in my mind, the biggest issue is what kind of a planet are we going to pass on? Is it going to be something that we would like to live in, or is it going to be something that where our children and grandchildren are going to pay a very high price for our ignorant behavior today?
You know, I want to encourage listeners who may wish to talk with Dr. Ehrlich to call 888-327-0061, because we will be taking your calls as appropriate in the next segment here. And I'd like to actually, in the next segment, kind of turn this over to you, but in particular talk about this concept of corporations, because I really feel that that's where the rubber meets the road. And as well, the issue of leadership. I believe we actually have an extinction on the planet of effective leadership. And any ideas on how in the world we inspire and create and bring to power enlightened leadership?
Good luck.
Well, you leave me there. I don't know what to say.
Well,
but that is the challenge.
I mean, look, I left the Republican Party when they denominated George Bush. There's a person who was essentially ignorant of everything, and the only accomplishments he had was to drive a series of corporations into bankruptcy. And yet, here's a person who knows nothing, who lies in his store teeth, and who's likely to be reelected to the President of the United States.
Dr. Ehrlich, hold on. When we return, we continue our discussion with Dr. Ehrlich, and we'll take your calls, 888-327-0061, with your questions here on the Wild Side News.